A recent study suggests that eating a healthy and balanced diet, such as the Mediterranean diet, and avoiding inflammation-producing foods may be protective against depression. Another study outlines the antidepressant food scale, which lists 12 antidepressant nutrients related to the prevention and treatment of depression. Foods like oysters, mushrooms, salmon, watercress, spinach, romaine lettuce, cauliflower, and strawberry. A better diet can actually impact your mood a lot. Why? Because foods with chemical additives and ultra-processed foods affect our gut environment, increasing the risk of all diseases. Ultra-processed foods contain substances extracted from foods, such as sugars and starch, items from food constituents like hydrogenated oils, and laboratory-made food enhancements such as food colorings, food dyes, and flavor enhancers. Ultra-processed foods such as fast foods are manufactured to be extra tasty, and they do that because of the ingredients and additives that are used. And they do it in a very cost-effective way for the consumer. Here is the typical Western diet. Canned foods, sugar-coated foods, salted meat products, sodas, packaged foods, breads, buns, pastries, instant soups, and fish and chicken nuggets are just the beginning of the foods that most Americans are eating on the regular. This is not good because when we consider the connection between the brain and the gut, we know that 90% of our serotonin receptors are located in the gut. My guest today is Dr. Drew Ramsey, a pioneer in the new field of nutritional psychiatry. A study that aims to help patients understand how gut health and diet can either positively or negatively affect their mood. When someone is prescribed an antidepressant drug such as an SSRI, the most common side effects are gut-related, and people may experience nausea, diarrhea, or gastrointestinal symptoms. And herein is an example of the anatomical and physiological two-way communication system between the gut and the brain that takes place via the vagus nerve. We need to ensure that we are eating in a way that helps us to conquer depression and anxiety while also having the added benefit of bolstering our gut health. Let's talk with Dr. Drew now about how we can go about eating food that helps us to beat depression and anxiety and truly become happy. This is The Lindsay Elmore Show. Welcome to The Lindsay Elmore Show, a podcast for people who deserve to be healthy with honest, open and enlightening conversations with doctors, thought leaders, creatives, and spiritual gurus, you'll walk away with simple and tangible tips and tricks that allow you to live your healthiest life so you can pursue your dreams, overcome obstacles, and leave your mark. Dr. Drew Ramsey is a psychiatrist, author, and mental health advocate. His work focuses on nutritional psychiatry, male mental health, and how to optimize mental fitness. He founded and leads the Brain Food Clinic, which offers consultations and integrative treatments around depression, anxiety, and emotional wellness. He is the assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons and in active clinical practice in New York City, as well as Jackson, Wyoming. He has been featured in the New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Lancet Psychiatry, The Today Show, BBC, and NPR, and has given 3 TEDx talks. He is the co-author of the Antidepressant Food Scale and his e-courses on nutritional psychiatry education for the public as well as clinicians. His award-winning books, Eat to Beat Depression and Anxiety, Eat Complete, 50 Shades of Kale, and The Happiness Diet, explore connections between mental health and nutrition. He is on the advisory board of Men's Health and the editorial board of Medscape Psychiatry. Dr. Drew Ramsey, welcome to the Lindsay Elmore Show.
Hey, Lindsay, it's so great to be with you. Hey, everyone. Excited to talk.
Yeah, we're going to talk all things brain health, and we're specifically going to focus on depression because depression has so many faces, and I think that we have this idea of what it means to be depressed, which I think for a lot of people, it's like, okay, just means somebody is sad, but it goes many, many layers beyond that. So talk to us about what is depression and what can be the variety of symptoms that people have.
Yeah. And first, I just thank you for, let's just dive in there. I'm a psychiatrist, everyone. And so, you know, depression is really near and dear to my heart in terms of what I think about. It's also the most disabling illness in the world in the United States. So it's really important for all of us to think about how depression is affecting our lives. Definitely either you or someone you know and love has clinical depression or has had clinical depression. And so it's a really important illness to talk about. It is an illness. I think a lot of people associate depression with sadness. And that's not depression. That's a sad mood. We have sad moods. I had sad moods last week, went through a lot of stuff, had some tears, you know, did some things, exercised, slept better, didn't drink, right? I feel pretty good today. That's not depression. That's sadness. Very normal, painful, annoying human emotion. Depression is a medical condition where we know a lot about it now we didn't know. We know that the brain is more inflamed. We know that there's changes in brain growth and brain growth factors. We know that a lot of the main mood regulating hormones, neurohormones, you know, things like serotonin and dopamine are affected. And when we influence those, we shift and can alter mood. So depression also affects appetite, energy, focus, irritability, sleep, and weight. So this really surprises people. So I'll meet someone that's like, I don't know what's going on. My brain is like foggy. I just don't enjoy stuff anymore. I'm kind of irritable. I'm snapping at my kids. I've gained like 10 pounds and I cannot sleep. And to me, that just is this person who described a form or a set of symptoms that meets criteria that's been going on for a few weeks of major depressive disorder. Mm-hmm. And it's surprising because that person also has probably sad mood or has to have sad mood to meet criteria. But those other symptoms like weight and sleep disruption, people often don't associate with depression, just like people don't associate diet with depression. Mm-hmm. And it's where, as I write in the book, Eat to Beat Depression and Anxiety, it's just where there's a lot of new data. Not that the only thing you need to do to beat depression in life is like eat more brain food. I eat a ton of brain food. I can tell you that's not the case for most people or for me. There's a lot that we have to do to keep our minds well, but most people are getting food really wrong. A lot of the wellness advice and diet advice I hear people getting is really wrong. I think the evidence has really been misconstrued and that people, Lindsay, there's a part that, I don't know, I've become like a brain advocate. This part that just really kind of honks me off is that people's eyes are not on the prize anymore. We're not paying attention to the most important aspect of nutrition, which is your brain health. There's nothing else that is more important. No other organ, no other concept. Nothing, because without brain health, we don't have anything. And that's where it's so exciting because there's a lot we now understand we can do to influence how we feel, how clearly we think, to help secure the stability of our mood. And also what I find really useful in what we call nutritional psychiatry is to give me things to do when I'm not feeling well besides go to therapy and take medicine.
Mm-hmm. I know.
I do. Both those things are great. I mean, I love both those things, but that's not all I want to be able to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, I'm a huge advocate of therapy, but it, you know, we're going to dive all into it. I definitely want to get into food and the nutrition advice that we're getting that's wrong. But I also want to go back a little bit to what is really going awry in this clinical presentation of depression? Because we have been bombarded since the late 80s that depression is a serotonin imbalance. And if we can get more serotonin in those neurosynaptic receptors and blah, 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 it's not just serotonin. Because if it was just serotonin, we wouldn't have problems with inflammation and with growth factors and with brain decay and with all of these other things. So talk to us, what is your best understanding of the pathophysiology, the what really is going awry, so that that can then lead us into, and in order to repair that, we're going to eat these foods and take on these lifestyle practices.
For sure. And what I like to do, especially for everyone listening, there's a lot of different people in how you think about and have experienced depression in your life. And so I like to think about categories. So there's certainly a category of individuals who, for example, are eating a really low quality, was often called the modern American or standard American or Western diet. This is a diet of a lot of fried food, processed food, candy bars, French fries, chips, sodas, lots and lots of calories, lots of industrial oils and seed oils, lots of sugar, obviously. We've been, just like serotonin, we've been hearing about how sugar is a toxin forever, right? And all that contributes to a lot of problems, obesity, diabetes, more inflammation. All of this increases obesity and diabetes, both double the risk of clinical depression. And then inflammation is now associated with at least a third of cases of clinical depression. There's also now really good genetic research saying, you know, the factors, the genetic factors that influence depression aren't really around autoimmunity. They're around the genes that respond to smoking and dietary choices, which really are two of the major kind of levers then that we all have in terms of regulating inflammation. And I've got a new e-course called Healing the Modern Brain coming out. And as we were building the course, we have a section on smoking. And I was like, guys, this is, you know, for the wellness community. Like, I don't know. And I'm like, look, a lot of people smoke. A lot of people vape. These are major factors regulating inflammation that we have a lot of control over. And so your great question, though, is like, what causes depression? And so let's talk about a few things that don't get talked about, because I feel like everyone bashes on serotonin. I prescribe SSRIs all the time. They're great medicines. People who are bashing on them do not know what the hell they're talking about and have not used them effectively in clinical practice. I've seen them not work. I've seen them cause withdrawal symptoms. I have treated all of those conditions. I don't want to dismiss the concerns about them, the debate about the evidence, right? All those are really interesting and valid points, but I think what gets lost in that, SSRIs are the safest, most effective, least expensive treatment for clinical and depression and anxiety that have ever existed. Period, right? And a lot of people benefit. 25% of women over the age of 60 take an antidepressant medication. So I don't want to pitch them. I just feel like because it's not just serotonin, as you pointed out, we've missed a big point. You know, what are the major things that Prozac and Zoloft do in the brain? They're anti-inflammatories.
I was going to say the only answer to this question has to be that they are anti-inflammatory.
And when I prescribe them now, yes, people are like, oh, those serotonin drugs. And I was like, really? I was like, that's not the only thing it does. It's also, that's the receptor it binds to. Yeah, there's more serotonin in the synapse. When you prescribe them, let me tell you, this disappointing thing happens. You give somebody medicine, whatever SSRI you like. And by the way, they're all a little different. That's when people
they
are like,
are
oh,
all a little
this
different.
One, this one was horrible. This one, and so... But you give someone medicine, serotonin goes up in the synapse right away. I mean, hours, but you don't see a clinical effect for 21 to 28 days. In the studies, actually 6 weeks. And when you see it, it's like, I don't know. I see that a lot because I've given a lot of SSRIs where you see that and now you see it on video and you just see someone and they're just, I mean, it's not a subtle thing. And so let's get back to food and how it relates, because one of the things that really, I guess, supports nutritional psychiatry in my work is we understand that antidepressants and treating depression really is about putting the brain into grow mode, allowing the brain to have these, you know, natural, I mean, your brain is always pruning systems, adjusting, dealing with toxins, always. So keeping those systems really kind of going and dynamic via the main hormone we know that controls that, BDNF. Treatments around depression both SSRIs and food are going to affect inflammation, you know, both via the microbiome, as we talk about later, we will talk about later with food. Also through having anti-inflammatory powers in and of themselves. And then there are things that medication and food can't do. And I think it's just important to mention those because we're talking about depression. If you had significant trauma, sorting that out doesn't have to be in therapy with an individual. It could be in a group. It could be through a spiritual experience, but working it out, I like talking it out. That's how I've best dealt with trauma in my life and with patients, because I'm a psychotherapist. But processing and putting these really complex feelings and experiences into words is really critical to us dealing with sad feelings that accompany things like grief and trauma, things that happen to us that are awful and painful. And so that's another aspect of depression I think is just really important to mention, especially now, because there's so much trauma going on now from the trauma of reading the news. Like I really, you know, I think a lot of us are like, I like being an informed person, but it's hard to sit with all of those images. Mm-hmm. And stay upbeat, positive, do your work, focus. Very challenging. So I think that's a long-winded answer to what is depression. Depression is a set of symptoms that affects your mood primarily, but also things like irritability, your weight, your attention, your clarity, your optimism, your hopefulness, your energy level. When you have symptoms like that that are lasting for more than 2 weeks, or it's acute, or it includes things like suicidal thoughts, for sure you have major clinical depression. If that's surprising to you and have those symptoms, I mean, I want to say it's really good news. There are lots and lots of really, really good treatments. And the first step to getting treatment is starting to consider if you have one of these diagnoses. There are a lot of different strands of depression. Depression can be caused by medical depression, so depression caused to medical illness. Like you have had a heart attack, so you're not getting enough blood flow to your brain. And so you get kind of sad and depressed. Actually, most patients now who have heart attacks get put on an antidepressant, because putting people on an antidepressant prevents a second heart attack and prevents depression. So a trial by Sandy Glassman at Columbia called the Sad Heart Trial. Really, and it just one of those early trials, it was a hint like, how does that work? And now we're like, Sandy was smart. Dr. Glassman understood there's something about inflammation going on in both heart disease and depression. So he put everybody on an anti-inflammatory. So
talk to us more about the category. So we said medical depression, and you mentioned a second ago that there were like seven different categories of depression.
Yeah, it's like, as I think about what causes depression, I put things in buckets, right? I think about, there's definitely trauma that causes depression. There's medical illnesses that cause depression, like hypothyroidism and anemia. There's medications that cause depression. So if you have hepatitis, you're going to get a treat hepatitis C, very, very, horrible and challenging illness. But you get treated with what's called interferon. And so many people get severely depressed with interferon treatment, it saves their liver, that they put people on antidepressant before they give the interferon. They're just like, look, you're going to get really depressed.
Well, and I got to give a shout out to the Depo-Provera shot. If we're going to talk about medications that cause depression, I just know so many women that have used Depo-Provera as a birth control option and go just spiral into the depths of depression.
An example where someone is looking at birth control options, the changes in hormones, that's great for some women. Love someone like this really stabilized me. Other women, I think it's where it's also a really good point, Lindsay, like, we all have individual responses. You know, I could take one of these medicines or St. John's Wort, or I could go on the brain food diet, right? And have an amazing response. And that's great. That's my response. That's your response. But it's sort of, I think, one of the things being a practitioner is it gives you hope, because you see people find their path and you help them do that. But also you see a lot of different things work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You see people. It's interesting, you know, being a pharmacist, you see medications and it's like, for one person, this medication is life-changing in the most powerfully positive way, where, you know, a tiny dose of metformin and boom, their diabetes is gone for life. They've got all these pleiotropic effects. They've got their life turns around for the positive. And then other people, it's like, same dose of metformin, raging lactic acidosis, or just nothing. And then you've got a higher dose and a higher dose. And so, yes, that individuality is really important.
Yeah. That's an illness we really understand in some ways. And I think what's frustrating with antidepressants is like, you know, I've given Zoloft to people and saved their lives. Like, there is no doubt, right? And had a really easy on and off and all that stuff, right? And I've given people the same medicine and had them have, you know, severe symptoms or just a lot of anxiety, or they didn't sleep, or they flipped them into bipolar disorder or mania rather. So it is, I think it's really, it's where we're trying to get a really good sense of how do we individualize and customize medications and give people really safe, quick trials so we get to them quickly to the treatment that works. And that's where a food is really, I think, a nice piece and an underutilized piece. Food's never been talked about in mental health. And I just think it's time to move on from that era and just think about when we assess every mental health patient, if you're struggling with depression or anxiety or other mental health symptoms, just quickly to look at your diet. It is not the only factor. Just like sleep isn't the only factor. Just like, you know, love and grief aren't the only factors, but they are major factors in terms of what regulate our overall health in our brain. And so if we just think about somebody, for example, I would just think about a young adolescent. You know, I treat a lot of adolescents. It's the beginning of the college season. So one of the great things about telepsychiatry is we get to be in like dorm rooms all over America. And it's really such a, first of all, boy, those things are small, right? But also
tiny. I know.
You get to be with young individuals as they're trying to sort out how do they feed their health and take care of their mental health with cafeteria food, or where can you order in, or what can you keep in your dorm fridge to really take care of your mental health, but also that fits on a student budget. So it's really fun to have those challenges as a nutritional psychiatrist. And when we think about those individuals, you know, the folks who are, you know, drinking a lot of beer and eating a lot of pizza and you know, having a lot of simple, empty carbohydrates often, not really getting a lot of plants in their diet often. You know, if they do, it's maybe it's a salad here and there, but not a lot of regular kind of plants, other than maybe French fries and chips. You know, the potato, the poor potato. Potato is such an amazing healthy food filled with iodine. You can make them with resistant starches. Potassium. I eat tons of potato. I have a potassium issue. I need less potassium. So, right. But it's the number one vegetable or food blamed for the obesity epidemic because we eat them as French fries and potato chips. But diet
and fry them in completely terrible oils along the way.
Right. Like we make lots of, you know, oven baked and olive oil French fries in our house. They're delicious. I think that's brain food compared with, an industrial French fry. Anyway, so food matters, and it's not. I think when we enter food through the lens of psychiatry, I hope with this book, and I hope with what I bring to the food conversation, people feel a little bit of a different vibe. I hope that people feel more encouragement to take a step back from the real nuttiness that has become the wellness industry and food and diet advice, and to really think about what is important. It's you and your diet, what's feasible on your budget, in your scenario, at your stage of life. What a 25-year-old woman should eat is not the same as what a 55-year-old man should be eating. And at the same time, there are food categories that just both 25-year-old women and 55-year-old men and anyone who is non-binary or in between, everybody with the brain should be eating a certain set of foods because they contain the most nutrients that our brain needs for the fewest calories. And if you're going to be in the game of trying to feed your brain with whole natural foods primarily, I'm not wholly anti-supplement. I just think that we start, and a lot of us, myself included, just need to do a better job of that and have more encouragement that we start with food and that we really get that right before we think about supplementation.
Yes, so I want to talk now about food because I think so often people are so ready to just find that magic bullet, you know, that they want their 5-HTP supplement and all the things. But it's, there is no silver bullet. There is no any of the things. And
call it the home run in my field, Lindsay. And I think all medical fields call it, it's the home run. Doctor, these are my symptoms. You know, I'm listening carefully, Lindsay. I want you to take this. 3 weeks, 21 days later, OMG.
Yeah, your life is completely overhauled.
I don't have anxiety. I sleep every night.
I haven't changed my life. I haven't changed my exercise routine.
That,
nothing.
You know, that does happen. If you have untreated bipolar disorder until you get on a mood stabilizer for most people, it does not, you know, what you eat is going to matter probably how much you get hospitalized, potentially. Some really interesting data now about nitrates. And there are some things like probiotics that I don't look like they might be able to help. So, you know, with really interesting high quality data, but bottom line is this, you know, until you have the silver bullet of finding the right treatment. And I think that often we just think that's a pill, and, you know, oftentimes meds really help. I've definitely hit some home runs with medications. I think I've also hit some home runs with some interpretations. When you really get to know somebody well, you sit with them, they trust you with that real inner world that we don't share with many people, like the real, raw, unfiltered inner world. And you, with them, create a set of ideas that really helps them metabolize and understand their experience, their ambitions, and what isn't working for them. It's a really magical thing, psychotherapy. So,
I'd like to go on, and I'd like to talk next about, you know, I was reading through all of the information that your team sent over to me, and it's like 12 ways to do this and 8 ways to do this and the eat to heal your brain and the this and the that. And part of the reason I think that food in the media, food and how, like, this person says intermittent fasting and that person says keto and that person says paleo and that person says vegan, it's so overwhelming. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Most skincare that is out there on the market is packed with lab-made ingredients that do damage to the internal structures of the skin and don't address the main reasons that skin looks old. What we need is skincare that actually addresses the 5 pillars that help our skin to look healthy, bounce back, and have a vibrant complexion. We need our skin to stay hydrated, have good blood flow, good collagen, good elastin, and to maintain our facial muscle tone. Primal Life Organics has a glow package that is specifically designed to address all 5 of these pillars. The products are super easy to use, and there are certain products to use in the morning and in the evening. Get up in the morning and wash your face with luxurious saponified oils in the Earth Facial Cleanser. Then apply the coffee bean serum to give your skin a quick jolt of caffeine, making it look alive and vibrant. In the evening, wash your face again with the Earth Cleanser, then exfoliate all of the day away using the Sweet Revenge Exfoliator, and then give your skin a big dose of antioxidants to absorb throughout the night with the Blueberry Elixir. This way, we will maintain our skin's inner structures now and into the future, and ensure that as our skin goes through the natural journey of aging, that we preserve, maintain, and build hydration, circulation, muscle tone, collagen, and elastin. Head to lindsayelmore.com/primallife to shop the Glow Package today. That's lindsayelmore.com/primallife to try out my new favorite skincare. And now, let's get back to the show. And it can make you a little bit batty trying to constantly do the right things. And so you mentioned...
And Lindsay, that's where I've been sort of a little shrimpy maybe in this way. That's just where I think people should start listening to me. I want to go keto. You know, it's my first question. It's like, how's that going to affect your brain? Uh-huh. It's interesting. If you go keto, you start feeding your brain cells different fuels. And until you've just thought about that, or whoever's preaching that has kind of walked you through the mental effects of ketogenic diets... Just some interesting data on that. For our clinician training program, we talked about this one really interesting study. You know, some potentially positive effects. I'm not for or against the keto diet, I'm for you taking care of your brain and thinking about what are the implications of something like a keto diet for the brain, and then how can we partner together to really test in a meaningful way. Is that the right diet for you? And anyway, I'm sorry. There is so much about ate this and ate that, and that's where nutritional psychiatry is different.
So how do we understand? So what am I listening for in between this space?
Right now, do we start, should we just start?
Yes, just dive in. Just okay. All right. So all right. All right, Doc, then you got to let me tell you my story, because the past couple days.
Story, Lindsay. I know everyone listening would love to hear your story.
Well, this was
a session. Look, this is a confidential moment we're going to share. Let's just keep this between you, me, and Lindsay. She's going to share.
Exactly. Just a couple of us. So over the past couple weeks, I don't know why, but something inside of me has been like, bake all of the things. So I have had a giant uptick in the amount of processed white flour, and it's organic cane sugar. So that's not real sugar, right? You know, all the things. So I have started to notice, number one, belly bloat, which I'm just like, okay. But I've also noticed these spells of feeling a little disconnected from myself, or feeling like I'm not grounded enough, or feeling like I'm a little woozy upon standing, and this and that. And finally, it was like, okay, it's time to stop baking pies, and it's time to stop making cookies, because there is something going on. And I have also, I love the concepts of addiction transfer, because they, I think, are so pertinent to everyone in life to really take. So this year has been my year of no alcohol. I'm just like, you know what? I really don't need alcohol in my life. And so it started out at the beginning of the year. It was like, well, instead of alcohol, I am going to exercise and I'm going to lose tons of weight. And then this go round, it's like, well, instead of alcohol, I'm going to do a lot of caffeine. And I've been noticing like this increase in the number of milligrams of caffeine that are happening to me every day. And so like in my brain, I'm like, okay, I know this isn't right for me, but yet there's another part of my brain that is like, no, you can just bake one more pie. You can just do one more thing. But I have a feeling that if I didn't have years and years of practice of actually trying to come into my own body and to come into my own brain and into my own mind, I might not have the awareness to go, maybe the reason that I've got kind of this like weird out of body kind of drifting sense is because I've just like crushed a ton of gluten or crushed a ton of sugar, or like something there is affecting my brain chemistry. So I guess that's a long way of asking, like, how do people come into this understanding and that knowing of when I eat this food, it's good for my brain, and when I eat that food, it's bad for my brain?
So thank you for sharing all that. And everybody, what I kind of listened to is Lindsay was painting a really nice picture, connection between a lot of things I think many of us think about and most Americans struggle with, which is caffeine tolerance and dependence. Coffee gets us going. It hits dopamine and serotonin, all the good stuff. All the studies say it's great for us. We start to sweat a little bit. We get stuff done. If we're in a bad mood, we feel better. If we need to get more done, we do. Maybe we get a little anxiety. And alcohol, we live in a culture that worships alcohol. Whether it's your, you know, a wine connoisseur or an IPAophile or you're a mixologist, there are a lot of different ways to have a lot of drinks a week, and usually drinks daily for a lot of people. And then there's a lot of genetic connection and a lot of connection between sugar cravings and alcohol. We now call it alcohol use disorder. And we always throughout my career call it addiction or dependence, right? And I really like alcohol use disorder. We're really trying to destigmatize it because there's so many different tools. And oftentimes people think, oh, you know, the only thing is AA, and to stop, AA works for a lot of people. It's free, I would point out. It's in every community. AA and going through AA and working the steps is like free psychotherapy. I highly recommend it. But the there are also all kinds of other things like naltrexone. But I would actually take one step back that Lindsay's describing. She made significant changes in her health. I'd want to hear as a clinician, what was happening and how was she feeling at the best? Was there a period before this baking bender? And then I think something happened to Lindsay My first association, because kind of what happened to me a few weeks ago, revolved around the Afghanistan withdrawal. And while I'm not in a military family, I guess I'm in a somewhat military family. I guess, I don't know why I said it. I am of a somewhat military family, having lost individuals in World War II in my family, and both my father and grandfather being in the Navy. And that might not be it for you, but I think sometimes when there's that uptick, we start to crave alcohol, sugar, baked goods, pies, right? Sometimes that has to do, sugar cravings, I think, a little bit with an edge of depression. And there's some theories that's not having enough tryptophan. Like sometimes there's like a lot of like meat or high tryptophan foods followed by sugar, which does increase tryptophan uptake into the brain. And anytime you do that, you increase serotonin production. And then you increase melatonin production. So, but I think I would want to know is if I were in a with my clinical hat on, Lindsay, is sort of what's going on dynamically with you as an individual, and to think about that psychology is resting on top of this physiology. And as, let's say that my theory or idea was right, there was something recently that really is starting to trouble and disturb you, that your brain is kind of thinking like alcohol, like where's my wine, alcohol. Also, you hit an anniversary 1 year. Alcoholics will tell you, and not saying you're one, but people who struggle with alcohol use disorder, they tell you like anniversaries are dangerous, because after you do a year, you're like, it's where we all love the month. Sober October, you're like 30 days. Like, you know, that's great, but that's not sobriety, you know. Sobriety is a real process. So I would, and then I think there's, to work the nutritional psychiatry piece, everybody. So all that stuff's really interesting. The alcohol use is really interesting. And then as a nutritional psychiatrist, I think, how do you reframe some of these things for Lindsay in terms of giving her some of that experience of either sweetness, pleasure? I'd much rather her have, if she's someone or one of my patients struggling with alcohol, or I treat a lot of physicians and, you know, as they struggle with alcohol, it's really, you know, serious. You want to give them good alternatives. Like I'd rather have some healthy pie. And then I think, well, how do we make the healthiest pie? And to think if that begins to appeal to Lindsay, like there are these really great chocolate nut torts made primarily with egg whites that I think are really interesting. We have an old family recipe I'd love to share with you, Lindsay. And then there's, I think ways, like in one of my books, there's a dark chocolate avocado mousse. You know, so you're getting some real brain food, really, you know, again, high nutrient density food. You're talking about the numbers. We do have, I have 12 power players. There's foods just, and I don't really like those lists, but you know, as the people who kind of help me shape these ideas point out, like it's got to be specific. So recommendations have got to be specific. We understand in nutritional psychiatry, we don't want to be too specific. I was the king of kale for most of the reign of kale. If people doubt that, I'd like anyone to challenge me. Yes.
Oh, I'd love to see you and Dave Asprey just go round and round about kale versus anti-kale.
I've been having a hard time understanding that. I think there's a little, you know, I have a little, my heart rate goes up because there's a little bullying in his content that concerns me.
Well, I have taken it taken it toe to toe because I'm like, bro.
Help me with this one, Lindsay, because I'm having a hard time with it. Kale is a low oxalate green.
And coffee is a high oxalate drink.
And so where I get upset about, you know, because if there was like, I was thinking if there was like a graphic novel about kale, he'd be like the Lord Voldemort, like the evil, you know, he'd be the evil guy, right?
Yeah, I know. In that universe, it is true, but I've been confused by
that. Can you help me understand that? Because I think it's, I guess what I get concerned about, as I said, is it such brilliant marketing?
Uh-huh.
And it's a brilliant marketing in an era of misinformation, where you put a piece of misinformation that gets all of us kaleophiles so riled up. I mean, do you think kale is a freaking toxin? I'm 47. I think I have more hair than Dave Asprey, and I've eaten kale almost every day of my freaking adult life. I launched National Kale Day. I wrote 50 Shades of Kale. I spread kale throughout public schools of America. It's just like, because it's a toxin? Like, come on. That's just ridiculous.
Well, and I think the idea that plants are out to kill us because they have bioactive compounds which are intended to protect them from predators. But I'm like, listen, dude, I'm not a fly out here. I'm not like a caterpillar chomping on some kale. The amount that you would have to take in. So it is just one of those things where, I mean,
I mean, what I don't understand is that's how I think it's supposed to work.
Yeah.
I think it's called hormetic stress. And anytime you eat anything, it is a metabolic shit show in your body. I mean, right. You're exploding carbon, you're burning stuff, there's free radicals everywhere. It is a mess of metabolism, right? I mean, it is like controlled fire. So, you know, you've been eating plants forever throughout your evolution. You've co-evolved with these molecules. That's why we recognize them and our genes respond to them. And it's certainly true. You know, one of the ways that kale works is it increases your liver detoxification enzymes. Why would you do that? Well, you do that if you want to eliminate more of that thing. But what's interesting to me is the same people who kind of pitch detox diets and boosting immunity, the idea that plants do that through the microbiome, the idea that phytonutrients do that by turning on and off certain genes, it's sort of, you know, that somehow doesn't seem to register account as much.
Yeah, it doesn't. So, okay, we have to wrap up very quickly here, but I would love for you just to talk to us about, you know, everybody that's been sitting here with their pen and paper and they're ready for the list. They want the list of the top foods. You mentioned dark chocolate. You mentioned avocado.
I tell everybody listening, here's what I want you to think about. First, I do the annoying therapist doctor thing, and I'm going to do it right now. First, thank you for listening, but I do want you, before you think about any magical food or silver bullet, just take a minute, reflect on your mental health. Everybody's had really, really challenging 18 months, no matter where you are, no matter your political affiliation, it's been hard. And so all of our mental health has been challenged. And as you assess your mental health, to think about how you're getting help and how much help you might need. There's lots and lots of different ways to get help for our mental health. I get all kinds of mental health from my mental help from my mental health. And I really recommend you do too. Whatever that means to you and that works for you. I want you then to do a second thing, which is just to take a little accounting of the food you've eaten for the last few days. Just think about it. Just like go back in your mind. What'd you have for dinner a couple of nights ago? It's hard to remember. We encourage people, and actually we've got some downloadable tools on our website, drimzmd.com, to kind of help you just take a little simple food journal. It's easy, though. You can just jot it down on a piece of paper, maybe, and to see if there's some connections, like the connection Lindsay made between your food and your mental health, whether it's caffeine, alcohol, and sugar. Great connection a lot of us have. That's one I really recognize, right? Where especially when I cut out alcohol, one of my secrets has been I add in sugar. And so my kids, what if somebody said to me, they said, what do you have? I said, oh, I have grape juice and seltzer. And they said, isn't that grape soda? And I said, like, yeah, kind of. They said, well, aren't you anti-soda? I said, well, yeah, I am. It makes sense. Well, during those phases, what I'm really anti and really after is cutting out alcohol out of my diet.
Right.
And a little bit of sugar for some grape juice, because I know that kind of my body is in a period of wanting that bubbles and little treat and a little reward. So, let's talk about the foods, though. We talk in food categories as nutritional psychiatry and the books Eat to Beat Depression and Anxiety, and you can check out all the details in there, but I have 12 power players. I have a little rhyme, seafood, greens, nuts, and beans, and a little dark chocolate. It can be a lot of dark chocolate. The reason is those are the food categories that we see in our clinic. We have a really wonderful clinical team of coaches, chefs, and therapists. And what we see is people struggle with certain food categories. People are eating this Western diet, and when they try and replace it, you know, often with something, you know, like an all plant diet or plant-based diet, a lot of processed foods get added in, or they end up hungry, or they don't get things like long-chain omega-3 fats or B12, which leads to significant mental health consequences potentially. So what we try to do is work those food categories. So some of my favorite foods, and they're, you know, let's start with some of the ones that people are like, ugh, but they're really great. I hated them, but things like sardines, anchovies, wild salmon, learning to make those at home. One of my patients is a college student, and he's got a kitchen in his dorm room. And so his big project for the week, he's going to make pesto for himself for the first time. And then next
week, I'm glad he's not making sardines. I'm like, his dorm mates are going to hate him.
But eventually, I think that we're going to be able to do, there's an exhaust fan, Lindsay. Don't worry. We're not going to stink up the dorm with fish. But those are the seafoods that I tend to recommend. And then bivalves, mussels, clams, and oysters, especially mussels, really easy, inexpensive, delicious, slow meal, lots and lots of zinc, lots of iodine, lots of omega-3 fats and B12 in there. In terms of beans, so small red beans have more antioxidants than any other food on the planet, surprisingly. I know there's a lot of debate about beans. I just point out, when you cook beans, you remove all of the stuff that everybody's debating about, like, you know, plants being toxic, and you end up with a lot of fiber and a good amount of protein. I think getting proteins, animal-based proteins from beef, from chicken, from seafood, I think doing that throughout the week is a great idea. I don't think only doing that is a great idea. And I think using more of meat is one of the things on your plate. What most people struggle with is getting enough greens and plants, no matter how much we talk about it, people just don't eat plants. And understanding how to do that. I eat a ton of plants. I eat probably an onion a day. I probably eat a big thing of broccoli every day. I have at least, you know, some sort of leafy green or cooked green at least every day. In each Beach Depression and Anxiety, I go through these food categories with my daily and weekly recommendations. And I don't want those to seem overwhelming to people. One of the things that I really hate is when folks who don't know anything about mental health are talking to people about mental health and nutrition. And since I'm a mental health clinician, our recommendations really revolve around understanding that people with depression and anxiety need individualized plans, need encouragement and support, and are really struggling with symptoms that a lot of people don't appreciate, and there's a lot of stigma about. And so this information isn't meant to be overwhelming at all. I'm hoping that maybe something like the recommendation, you swap out all the oils in your house for olive oil for the next month and go through like a liter of it, pour it on a lot of vegetables, roast a lot of vegetables. Try and having a small serving of beans a couple times a week. Try eating more seafood over the next couple of weeks and see if you can begin to really identify foods that help energize you and patterns that help energize you. The other big recommendation is fermented foods. The way that we really operationalize this for people is through our smoothies. I use kefir, but you can also use a coconut kefir. Kefir is like a more liquidy, a little more tart yogurt, and it's great for smoothies. But a classic kind of Drew Ramsey anti-depression smoothie is going to be some nuts, some kefir, oftentimes some plant in there, either an avocado or some leafy greens, and then some sort of like berries or banana, right? We're getting a lot of either, again, even the people who don't like plants like berries. So they yes. like berries and potatoes, even the meat only folks, I think those things we tend to, and honey, we tend to all agree on those. I've got bees on my farm, so, you know, I'm biased about. Some of the other ones that are surprising, pepitas and cashews. Those are some of the power players. Pepitas, pumpkin seeds. Those are my smoothies and my omelets. They're a top source of tryptophan. Really nice source of fiber. Really nice source of zinc as well. And then the book revolves around, and you can Google this for those of you interested. I wrote a paper with Laura Lachance called the Antidepressant Food Scale. It's a really simple paper that just looks at what are the nutrients most important for depression and what foods have the most of those per calorie. And that's what led to some of these food categories. And so I hope that is folks who are listening and thinking about foods, you know, the cover kind of has all of the ones I just mentioned.
I like it.
You know, so there are a hint there. And then just another thing to show off is within the book, I talk about those nutrients that inform the antidepressant food scale, like vitamin B6, and really try to talk about the food sources, but also some tips and tricks around how to get more of vitamin B6. And we go through all 12 nutrients like that, as well as a few others like monounsaturated fats and choline and a complete protein, a few things that really matter to mental health and anxiety and depression.
Very cool. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Drew Ramsey, for your book, Eat to Beat Depression. And honestly, I just want to say thank you for your approach, not trying to say, here is the diet. Eat these things every day and you will no longer be depressed, but actually teaching people how to hone in and understand that when I eat this, I feel this way, and giving permission for that to be of an utmost importance, irrespective of what Instagram and the news tells you to eat or what the newest study says or this or that. Listeners, go and check out DrewRamseyMD.com. Pick up a copy of Eat to Beat Depression and Anxiety. And if you dare, go and read 50 Shades of Kale too. So,
and Lindsay, everybody should come. We started a new cooking class called the Mental Fitness Kitchen.
Yeah.
So everybody should come. We've got free classes. We've got some paid classes. So that's a great thing to check out. And a really one way to meet our clinical team for anybody who wants to learn some of these brain food skills. And, you know, maybe it sounds intimidating. Like last week we did baked sardines, which I'd never done. Really delicious. Didn't stink like fish. Really delicate, delicious meals. We've got a great chef, Emily Berner, who's a coach and a chef, and myself teaching these classes. So, but yeah, thank you so much, Lindsay. It's really fun to talk with you. Thank you so much for your questions about depression. And I know we've got to stop, but I feel like we could keep talking more and more. Maybe I'll be able to come back someday. And thank you so much for everything you do to spread the word about nutritional psychiatry and help fight stigma and mental health and give people really good tools to take care of their brains. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. We're a show for people who believe that they deserve to be healthy. And I do believe that everyone deserves to eat in a certain way that gives them the ability to overcome depression and anxiety. So thank you.
Everybody deserves mental health. That's entirely true. Cheers, Lindsay. Have a great day. Thank you so much. And thanks everybody for listening.
When you first get started using crystals, it can be confusing to know if you're truly getting what you pay for. Are you paying a fair price? And how do you know that the crystals that you choose have not been procured at the expense of another human being's safety, dignity, welfare, or human rights? That's why when it comes to crystals, I shop at Wild Alabaster. The Begin collection is designed specifically for people who have never used crystals before. In this collection, you'll get a selenite, perfect for clearing the environment. You'll get a smoky quartz, which helps to cleanse and detoxify the environment, alongside a sage bundle, which you can use to clear out old energies. You'll then get a charging amethyst druzy, as well as a clear quartz. You can also stash a chunk of rose quartz somewhere around the house to bring you comfort and solace anytime that you feel a need for a little bit of self-love. Come and shop the Begin collection. Whether you are brand new to using crystals or whether you just want to recharge your collection of amethyst quartz, rose quartz, smoky quartz, and selenite, this is the perfect collection of hand-chosen stones that can help you to recharge your environment. Head to lindseyelmore.com/wildalabaster. That's lindseyelmore.com/wildalabaster and grab a collection to get you started. The Lindsay Elmore Show is written and produced by me, Lindsay Elmore. Show segments are produced by Sue Procco and Derek Lugo. Sound design and editing is by Jive Media. Support the Lindsay Elmore Show by heading to lindseyelmore.com/podcast. Your contribution, no matter how big or how small, helps us to bring the best guests to the interview chair. Thank you so much for listening. Subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Share this and all of your favorite episodes with a friend and on social media. Be sure to tag @Lindsay Elmore Show and help us bring the pod to more people.